and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the House Intelligence Committee has completed and issued its report concluding that there was no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. The Democrats issued a dissent. And the Daily Beast has suspended columnist and MSNBC host Joy Reid after dozens of homophobic statements were added to her old blog on the MSNBC website. Reid says that the blog was hacked. Her supporters suggested that maybe the Russians were responsible, and the FBI is now investigating. But Daily Beast cybersecurity reporters and the website's webmaster say there is no evidence of any hack. Also, the corporate-owned media is making a big deal of the emails hacked from the Russian attorney who met in July 2016 with Donald Trump Jr. Next, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is making a one-day trip to Washington today to meet with President Trump and to discuss the Iran nuclear deal and pending U.S. tariffs on German steel and aluminum. Most media outlets say that the meetings will have none of the warmth seen during French President Macron's visit to Washington earlier this week. Then, a recent spate of infections linked to romaine lettuce is now the largest multi-state foodborne E. coli outbreak since 2006. At least 84 people have been affected in 19 states by contaminated lettuce originating in Yuma, Arizona. And then, an international conference aimed at raising aid for victims of the Syria conflict raised just over half of what the United Nations says is needed to support refugees. Just $4.4 billion was raised. The U.S. had pledged $1 billion, but has not delivered any of that. And finally, it's Friday. Time for a regular look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Russiagate, the story that just will not go away. The House Intelligence Committee has completed and issued its report, concluding that there was no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. The Democrats issued a dissent, and the Daily Beast has suspended columnist and MSNBC host Joy Reid after dozens of homophobic statements were added to her old blog on the MSNBC website. Reid claims that the blog was hacked, her supporters suggested that maybe the Russians were responsible, and now the FBI is investigating. But Daily Beast cybersecurity reporters and the website's webmaster say there is no evidence of any hack. Meanwhile, the corporate-owned media is making a great deal out of the emails hacked from the Russian attorney who met in July 2016 with Donald Trump Jr. We'll talk about all of this with Joe Loria. He joins us from Washington. Joe is a journalist and a political commentator and author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And he's also the editor-in-chief of Consortium News. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John.
Joe, there's so much to talk about in this limited time. First, let's start with the House Intelligence Committee report. The Democrats already have issued a dissent. The report is relatively heavily redacted, but the bottom line is clear. There's just no evidence of collusion. Do you buy that?
Well, we haven't seen any. And the House interviewed 73 witnesses. They looked at 300,000 documents, as they say in this report, and they did not find any evidence of collusion. But they do buy the story that Russia interfered in the election and has done many other things, but without, as far as we could see in this, as you said, a heavily redacted report, without, again, providing any evidence that they hacked the DNC computer or John Podesta's emails, or that RT is used as a way to, as a disinformation or a propaganda channel to sow discord in this wonderful American democracy. So the report accepts all of that, and yet it doesn't, as far as we could tell, does not provide any evidence for that. What it does do that the Democrats really are upset about is it says they couldn't link any of the nefarious Russian activity to anybody on Trump's team. And nobody has proven either one of those. But they do accept. They also call, by the way, WikiLeaks a hostile foreign organization. So that tells you where the mindset of this House committee report was.
That's right. And, you know, it's funny, too, because during the campaign, Donald Trump crowed that he loved WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks, he said. Until Mike Pompeo came out and called it a hostile foreign intelligence service. And we see that repeated now by the House Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, so the takeaway here is that the Republicans are saying, look, there's no evidence of collusion, the Republican majority. There's no evidence of collusion There is evidence that Russia engaged in nefarious meddling in the U.S. electoral process. The Democrats agree with that, but their dissent, I assume, will be what? I mean, in other words, they're agreeing with the Republicans. Maybe they're only disagreeing about whether Trump himself has or the Trump campaign has culpability. Or do they even say that?
Yeah, well, they're saying that it ended too soon, this investigation, and that they hadn't interviewed enough people, hadn't reviewed enough documents, hadn't issued more than 20 subpoenas. But I mean, there has to be an end to this at some point. Were the Republicans politically motivated? Are they protecting Trump? That's the Democratic charge. I think they are politically motivated. I think and many other skeptics of the Russiagate story are not motivated, certainly by any partisan interests. It's simply looking at evidence and seeing what happened. And this report, unless it's in the redacted portions, which is a huge amount of this report, we don't see the damn evidence of Russia doing any of the things they're accused of. And the Republicans are simply saying that Trump people were not colluding with that. And it kind of makes sense. Even if Russia hacked the DNC and gave the emails even through an intermediary that Assange didn't know about, what role would the Trump campaign have in that? Did they need them to know if that's an intelligence operation on a need-to-know basis? Why would anybody in the Trump campaign need to know that they were going to hack the DNC and send it to WikiLeaks? It doesn't make any sense. So this report doesn't advance anything. It just shows the ire of the Democrats in wanting to continue keeping this story front and center and trying to pin something on Trump himself. Absolutely would be the best for them or anybody in the Trump campaign. And that has not happened yet. So they're just upset that this is one of the three investigations going on has come to an end. They don't want it to end.
You know, I think there's another issue here, too, if I could interrupt you for 1 second. We look at this investigation. We look at the Senate investigation into the CIA's torture program. And what we have are really very partisan or what ended up being very partisan investigations. Time was where at least intelligence on Capitol Hill was a bipartisan issue where both parties worked together for the better of the country. And that's just not the case anymore. Now we see the Republicans publish their report. The Democrats publish a dissent. It happens both in the House and the Senate. Do you think that's the future here for these kinds of investigations? Are we no longer going to see cooperation on intelligence issues?
Well, we do see a bipartisan aspect to this. Both parties think Russia interfered in this election and is trying to destroy our democracy, and that WikiLeaks is a hostile organization. So it's just there is bipartisanship their views of Russia. Obviously, in the Middle East, they have the same views. So there's still a lot of bipartisanship in foreign policy and intelligence matters. Where they differ is whether the Trump campaign was involved, and that's highly partisan, obviously. The Democrats want to nail these guys, and the Republicans want to protect them. But it's up to the Democrats to come up with the evidence. Now, they say this investigation didn't go on long enough. Maybe, maybe not. But they did do all these interviews and documents they reviewed. And we've got the Senate Intelligence Committee and of course, Mueller's investigation still ongoing. So if there's something there, those others should come up with it. So that's where the bipartisanship ends, when you want to pin it on the Republicans as having somehow taken part in this alleged Russian interference.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is, at the end of the day, this thing isn't going to end. Russiagate isn't going to end. The Republicans want to say Hillary Clinton lost because of the Russians. The Democrats want to say that. The Republicans want to say the Russians interfered, but not to the benefit or not with the collusion of Donald Trump. Again, there is no evidence that's been provided. I mean, when you look through, and we followed this story almost every day for the past 2 years. When I talk to people and they say, well, Sputnik and RT, I did an interview with someone in a major media outlet. I said, well, what's the evidence of collusion? What's the evidence that Russia's actually doing it? And she said to me, well, Sputnik and RT, like the fact that they exist. But then I said to her, well, you know, here in Sputnik, my show, Loud and Clear, which is now co-hosted with John Kiriakou, that's the first show here on Sputnik. In the United States than By Any Means Necessary. Other shows came on. During the entire 2016 election campaign, we were all virulently against Donald Trump. And it just doesn't matter. It's like this article of faith. The Russians used RT and Sputnik to help Donald Trump win, but there's no evidence of that.
No, but it fits their political narrative, though.
Yes, and it will not go away because look at the lawsuit against Russia, WikiLeaks, and the Trump campaign that the Democratic Party just filed. That they're going to run on that in this midterm election and presumably in the next presidential election. That's why they won't let it go away. They're going to run on something, on a lawsuit that even a mainstream commentator like Gloria Borger on CNN called 100% political stunt to raise money. So she's saying, and she knows the inside of this campaign, of this party rather, that they're using Russiagate as an electoral instrument, not as a serious criminal or even civil investigation, because this is not probably going to come before a judge, and certainly Russia would not be able to pay any damages or whatnot. So the people in the voters of the Democratic Party, who in many polls want single payer health care, want an end to perpetual warfare, this is all being ignored by the Democratic establishment. They're still going to go after Russia, as this lawsuit shows, and I think it's going to come to a sorry end for them again.
The governor of West Virginia, again, Republican, and the Democrats will be all for this, has called out the National Guard for the midterm, or called out, that's the headline is called out. They're really working with the West Virginia National Guard to protect West Virginians from Russian meddling in 2018. I mean, and this is going to be spreading around the country where the National Guard is being mobilized, as if Russia really has this agenda to spread chaos. It's considered an absolute, it's assumed as an actual truth, even though, again, one, why would Russia do it? Why would anyone think Russia has this kind of sort of reach, this kind of impact on America is beyond me.
We were moving into the realm of complete insanity and state repression. If you're, what you're saying is true, that the National Guard will be deployed for a fantasy, I guess, a fantasy threat. It's chilling, very, very chilling and very dangerous where this is leading to. I just don't have any more words to say about that.
Yeah, and now the Democrats and Republicans demanded Jill Stein, a third party, to hand over internal Stein Green Party campaign documents to their House Intelligence or to their Senate Intelligence Committee. These are the Democrats and Republicans now attacking third parties because, guess what? Jill Stein wants peace with Russia.
Imagine that. I wanted to just touch on this Joy Reid thing. We only have a minute, believe it or not. But Glenn Greenwald tweeted something today that's, I think, really telling. He says, "It's unbelievable. Maybe I'm missing a few, but the only acknowledgement I see of the extraordinary Joy Reid hacking claim from any liberal outlet is this tweet from the editor of Crooks and Liars, blaming it on Putin. It's like a full-scale media blackout otherwise." And he's referring to something tweeted by Karoli, at Karoli, who's the Crooks and Liars editor. And she says, "FYI, y'all, there's an organized effort by hard right trolls to slime Joy-Ann Reid. It involves hackers, alterations to an old inactive blog, and right wing amplifiers, maybe even Russians. Mediaite is running the smear without the facts because clicks." Like, have we really devolved to this level now where literally everything is blamed on the Russians?
Yes, I think anytime any establishment figure or elite figure is in some kind of trouble or is open to criticism, they're going to blame Russia for it. It seems to have worked for them so far. They're going to keep doing that.
That's what it comes down to. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were joined from Washington by Joe Loria. Joe's a journalist and political commentator. He's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton, and he's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, joined in studio by my co-host Brian Becker. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is making a one-day trip to Washington today to meet with President Trump and to discuss the Iran nuclear deal and pending U.S. tariffs on German steel and aluminum. Most media outlets say that the meetings will have none of the warmth seen during French President Macron's visit to Washington earlier this week. We're joined from Geneva, Switzerland by Rainer Braun. He is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau, and we're joined in studio by Sputnik News political analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Hello.
Rainer, let's start with you. I have to laugh at the U.S. press today. Everybody is presenting this Merkel visit as if it's a funeral being held at the White House. Tell us a little bit about the dynamic between Angela Merkel and Donald Trump. They're both conservatives, so why don't they get along?
You know, can you imagine when you would be a real scientist who was making science for about 30 years in your life, trying to find new things, trying to be next to the truth and develop a scientific approach? What can you do with such a guy like Trump? Either you can laugh about him, you can ignore him, you can say, I will never speak with him, or when you have to speak with him, it is a lot of pressure on Merkel to sit together with such a man. She's an intellectual woman. Many people who have the possibility to talk to her notice that she is really very clever in the mm-hmm. discussion, mm-hmm. that she can listening, that she can argument, and everything of this is the opposite of Trump. And there's another point. You can say about the conservative Merkel whatever you want. She's definitely not my favorite, but she is not corrupt. She's not working for her own pocket. And I have not to tell you what Trump has done in his life.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that Merkel is going to raise, Reiner, is the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. President Macron lobbied President Trump hard this past week to remain in the accord. Merkel is going to say the same thing, but the word is that Trump wants to pull the country out, and that will likely happen on May the 12th. What's the German response going to be if the U.S. ends this accord?
You know that Germany is for this deal has not at all, and not in the beginning, and not as a majority to do with peace. Iran is traditionally a very important trade partner from Germany.
Yes.
We were working together with the Shah for many, many years, even in the end of the 90s, beginning of the 20th century. We had strong and intensive relations to Iran. Many of the young Iran intellectual people were educated and trained in Germany. And the hope of the German big industry is to make profit with a new development after the Iran deal. Partly it works, but not in total, because not all sanctions, but all bank sanctions were overcoming. And so what Trump is doing is deeply against the economical and political interests of Germany, which want to play important role in the region. And the important role means that Germany try to find a little bit of balanced politics between Saudi Arabia, which is deeply supported by Germany, above all by arms trade, and Iran, to play a more important role in the whole Middle East issue. All of this only works when the deal will continue working and be the background of all the future agreements. So it is deeply against German interest what Trump is doing. And Merkel was trying to put all her arguments together. And I think she will be really well prepared. But for me, it is not a question of arguments. Trump had, I don't know by which reasons, decided that she does not want this. And I cannot see that anyone can convince him. And you know, the reaction of Macron yesterday in the French parliament, where he explained his deep disappointment about the reaction of Trump, shows that he also not believes that there will be an ongoing Iran deal after May 12th.
Walter Smolarek, this is a very important point that Reiner raises here. If Trump makes the decision to withdraw from the nuclear deal, we've said on this show, or I said, and I think now I said it incorrectly, that trade was so important to the likes of Germany and France and the UK that they would either work together to convince Donald Trump to remain in the deal, or failing that, just ignore the fact that the US had these sanctions that statutorily had to be reimposed. I think I was wrong in that analysis. So do you think that the Germans, the French, the British, and others will fall in line, or are we going to see a diplomatic fight between the United States and its allies in Europe?
Well, I can't see them really truly standing up to Donald Trump. I mean, at least we've seen no indication that they would do that so far. I mean, Macron was saying, oh, well, you know, he's probably going to withdraw, but maybe we can get a new deal, which is, you know, of course, ridiculous. You know, the Iranians will never accept that, and nor should they. I think that they may be willing to look the other way on Iran. I mean, I think, you know, the Europeans, especially Merkel, are genuinely concerned about, you know, the John Bolton type forces that like truly actually want to have like a war with Iran. That would be so destabilizing for the world that I truly think that they would, you know, maybe that's something that they could spur into action. But just withdrawing from the JCPOA, I don't know, it doesn't seem like that is going to sort of meet the threshold of destabilization that would make them finally get their act together. You know, I think that one thing that they do think they could get like a serious concession out of Trump is perhaps on tariffs. I think the economic dimension of this is pretty interesting. I mean, Angela Merkel, especially since the economic crisis broke out in 2008, has been the de facto leader of the European Union. And the prescription, the policy prescription that, you know, under her leadership was developed is, you know, the most extreme version of neoliberal orthodoxy. You know, like just devastating austerity measures were imposed on countries that are considered to be on like the periphery of the Eurozone, and also in the core too, to a lesser extent.
Sure.
You know, getting rid of labor regulations, trade union rights, cutting massively pensions and other social programs, you know, subjecting countries to this almost like colonial type of financial supervision. Greece, Cyprus, Ireland, Portugal had to enter into, you know, quote unquote memorandums. So, you know, Trump, in a way, does similar things, right? Like the tax bill was a massive giveaway to the rich at the expense of the poor. You know, he's certainly no friend of social programs, but he's also, but he is willing to pursue sort of like trade protectionist measures, which does clash a little bit with the economic direction, the economic course of the Eurozone that the Eurozone has been following under Merkel's leadership.
The other issue that Merkel's going to raise at the White House today is this issue of tariffs. We said on this show when the tariffs were first announced that the conventional wisdom that they were going to hurt the Chinese, the Russians, was just simply not true, that they were going to be targeted most directly at our friends and allies, Canada, Mexico, Germany, the UK. Well, that's exactly what's happened. So, Reiner, what do you think is going to come out of these talks related to steel and aluminum? Do you think that Merkel will be able to get a waiver?
You know, let me first say I'm not a friend of free trade. These free trade where the poorer will be suffering and the richer will be rich, and the rich countries will press the poor countries like the European Union is doing with the African countries. This is not my favorite, and it is not an alternative to a very nationalist trade politics like Trump it wants. The alternative is justice trade, an international justice rule for trade. So that is, we have to be very cautious that we are not jumping from one side to the other side. Both sides are wrong and against the majority of the people. So what the German industry needs by their big export is free trade, and Merkel will do everything that this will be continuing the best possibilities. You know, we are changing our trade system partly from Europe to Asia. We have developed new free trade zones with Latin America, with Japan. So we are really searching for alternative partners. But every trade sanction in the U.S. is a big, big pressure to the German industry, above all to the car industry, which is one of the main working givers in Germany. So that is for Merkel a very, very important point, and she will really fight with all their possibilities, including speaking with the different parts in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and in end to reduce the pressure on Germany in this case. Frankly speaking, Germany is part his own fault that there is this big problem, because we are not investing enough in our internal affairs, school, education, and. This will reduce these big export plus. So part of the critics from Trump are totally correct, but the alternative between free trade is not national trade, is a fight for a new justice world trade order.
Right. Walter, in the last 30 seconds that we have, was this Trump's plan all along to divide our partners, to weaken them, and to negotiate individual deals?
Well, he has been saying for quite some time that he prefers bilateral trade deals to multilateral ones. I don't think that we should necessarily ascribe, you know, like long-term strategic thinking to that, though.
Okay. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from Geneva, Switzerland by Reiner Braun, co-president of the International Peace Bureau, and here in the studio by Sputnik News political analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A recent spate of infections linked to romaine lettuce is now the largest multi-state foodborne E. coli outbreak since 2006. At least 84 people have been affected in 19 states by contaminated lettuce originating in Yuma, Arizona. We're joined from Washington by Patty Lovera. She's the Food and Water Policy Director at Food and Water Watch. Patty, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Patty, how can this happen in 21st century America?
Well, there's a couple things. We're still trying to figure this particular outbreak out, but there are a couple kind of trends in play here. One is that there is risk. You're growing vegetables outside. And so we're going to find out, hopefully, eventually what caused this actual contamination. It may have been wild animals. So there have been outbreaks in the past where it was deer getting into the fields or something like a wild pig or something like that, birds. There's potential that it was some kind of water used in the process wasn't clean. Occasionally it can be workers who haven't washed their hands. I mean, there's a lot of different ways this can happen. And a food like leafy greens, other foods, you cook them. And so that gives you one last chance to kill that bacteria. You don't do that with a salad mix, right? You've lost that chance. So we are seeing a trend as people, there's a good thing, maybe hopefully people are eating more leafy greens, which is good nutritionally, but, you know, they do have some risk with them. And then the other piece of this that we're really interested in is we have really consolidated our food production at this point, and we produce a lot of food in fewer places, but those places are pumping out a lot of it. Mm-hmm. So when something goes wrong in one of those places, we now see, you know, national impacts from that. We don't have a regional food system anymore where the problem would be restricted to that region. We have a pretty national food system, and we have big plants that could take a little bit of contamination and spread it out through a bigger pool of product and then send that to a large part of the country. So we kind of amplify a problem that may have started in one little spot. We have a good system for spreading that problem out.
And then tell me, is there anything that people can do to protect themselves other than just boycotting, let's say, romaine lettuce from Yuma, Arizona? If you wash the salad, even if it looks clean, but you wash the lettuce when it comes out of the bag, will that protect you? Is that enough?
It's not enough, unfortunately. There's just a lot of places, in terms of kind of just the biology and the microbiology of what's going on, there's a lot of places for bacteria to kind of grab on and stick in a lot of different foods. Lettuce is one of them. But we do know a couple things. So there's no foolproof way. So that's the frustrating part. So we do need to have a better system, you know, with regulations and inspections and things like that to prevent these problems, because it's not really in our hands as consumers to completely solve the problem at home. But there are a couple things that we're starting to see. We're seeing more and more of these types of outbreaks in kind of the bagged salad arena, where it's been chopped up and mixed up more. There's a couple potential reasons for that. One is you're taking basically the parts of many different heads of lettuce that end up in that bag, you know, because it's in a giant processing plant where lots of heads of lettuce kind of end up in that mixing bowl. And so it's not just the odds of that one head of lettuce you may have bought being contaminated. You're kind of getting little bits of lots of heads. The other thing is, the more we process some of these foods, they are starting to look more at, you know, every time you make a cut, is that opening up a surface where a bacteria could get in?
Right.
And so there's some folks who think maybe it's time to go back to buying, you know, whole heads of lettuce, more intact sources, and then doing some of that yourself at home later in the process. So there's a lot we're still learning about that, but we're seeing a lot of these outbreaks in this bagged salad arena, but we also didn't have these bagged salads 20 years ago. So it's a little bit, without a crystal ball, we're not exactly sure what's going on.
We're talking about the E. coli breakout with a romaine lettuce in this instance, but of course, as Patty is telling us, John, it's not just lettuce. It could be spinach or beef. There's lots of places where this happens. Patty, you know, everybody cares about food, and that's why I love your website, which is foodandwaterwatch.org, and I encourage our listeners to go to the site, sign up to be informed about these issues about food and water, instead of, you know, people, and a lot of times we don't think. It's everything is routine. You go to the store, you buy stuff, you make it, you make the same things over and over again for the most part. You turn your tap on, you drink water. You know, it's all, you know, we do it without thinking, but it's important to be thinking and to get information about it. One of the things, Patty, I'd like you to talk about is the, you're talking about the concentration of food production. So, which makes food perhaps cheaper. Certainly big industrial farming has a cost limitation or a reduction in cost, but it also has other risks. One, is that the problem? And can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in Arizona with this particular source? And two, what can people do at home, say, when you want to make a salad, if you've bought romaine lettuce, does washing the lettuce make a difference?
So the advice, you know, from the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration and the folks who were tasked with figuring this out is, their advice usually is, when in doubt, throw it out. And so if you think you've got romaine lettuce, you can't tell where it came from, the best advice is probably to throw it out. When it's something like E. coli, you know, you can't see it. It's not that if you just wash off some of the, you know, maybe you see some leftover soil or dirt, that may not get rid of it. So there's not really a washing step that's a sure thing to help you in this case. The one, and so this is why we kind of always have to come back to, like, what is our regulatory system and what is our system to prevent these problems? Because there's just not a surefire way to protect yourself at home. If we were talking about, you know, potatoes or meat or chicken, we would say, you know, get a meat thermometer, make sure it's cooked. That is going to kill the bacteria, but you just don't get to do that with some vegetables that you eat raw. So, and we have a lot of traceability gaps for consumers to know exactly where this stuff is coming from. We have such consolidation in really every food in our food supply. There's a couple big players who are kind of dominating the market. And so it depends on the time of year. We're just coming out of the season where most of our leafy greens are being grown in Arizona. And now they'll shift back to not even the whole state of California, but like one area of California really centered around Monterey County on the coast, and they call themselves the Salad Bowl because for a good chunk of the year they're producing most of the leafy greens that most Americans are eating. I mean, we really, and some of this is the economics of, you know, if people have read about food policy and they've heard about get big or get out, this is what happens. You know, like the small guys can't compete when they aren't getting paid very much, and folks who can get bigger, they're the ones who kind of capture a lot of the market. And also specifically with leafy greens, we now see that most people are buying leafy greens pretty processed, right? We're buying these bags where they've already been washed, cut up. And that takes infrastructure. You know, small farmers don't have the machinery and the processing plants to do that. So that change in the industry is also driving us towards these bigger players because they have the infrastructure to process the salad greens in that way. The other tip I will say is just because it's a time of year, most parts of the country, we're slowly seeing spring. You know, you can, leafy greens are really easy to grow. So it is something that if you want to know exactly where they came from, you can do it in an apartment. You can do it in a window box. You can go to the farmer's market and you can ask people there those questions. What do you do? How do you keep deer out of the fields? What water source do you use to water these greens? Are you confident in it? Right now, we're very far behind in creating a regulatory system that provides the level of prevention that we need. This has been a long, drawn-out process to get the Food and Drug Administration to come up with kind of sensible regulations that work for everybody. But we see when these outbreaks happen that we do need to do the work and figure that out.
We have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you your opinion on something. Do you trust the government to protect us from things like E. coli, to make sure that the system works? Is this an anomaly that we're seeing right now?
I don't think it's an anomaly because we have seen leafy green outbreaks before, quite a few of them. You know, in terms of trust, I think there's a lot more that the government should be doing. And it's a constant uphill battle to get them to do it. So there's been a lot of controversy. Like if you look up something called the Food Safety Modernization Act that passed in, I think it got signed in the beginning of 2011, and we are still waiting to see exactly what it's going to do on the ground. Having said that, you could do it badly, and you could hurt the small farmers who I think are doing a good job. But if you write these rules the wrong way, it's hard for them to live with them. But we have outbreaks like this from the big guys, and we want to see that there's a better system in place. Right now, we're very dependent on these industries to come up with their own standards and to follow them, and then that makes us dependent that they've written the right standards. And we're really struggling to get to a point where FDA has good science that leads to a regulation that works for everybody so they can all stay in business, and then they have inspectors out there actually making sure it's being followed. They're very underfunded when it comes to actually getting inspectors out to see what's going on the ground.
Yeah, you're listening to Patty Lavera. She's with the Food and Water Watch organization, and you can go to their website, foodandwaterwatch.org. Patty, in our last 30 seconds, when these kind of outbreaks happen, are they short-lived? I mean, do we expect that in a few weeks this will be taken care of, or is it a bigger, longer-term problem?
With something like lettuce that's very perishable, they call it a curve, and you see like a peak of number of cases of people getting sick, and then it kind of tails off and goes away because the thought is whatever that problem batch of product has probably been eaten, and if it didn't get eaten, it got thrown out because it's not good anymore. We see longer outbreaks in processed foods because they might be sitting on a shelf for a while, or meat, you know, chicken or meat might be in somebody's freezer. With fresh produce, it does tend to die out, because it doesn't last that long. The question is, are we going to figure out the exact cause before that happens?
Okay, well, thank you. We're out of time. We were joined from Washington by Patty Lavera. She is the Food and Water Policy Director at Food and Water Watch. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
An international conference aimed at raising aid for victims of the Syria conflict raised just over half of what the United Nations says is needed to support refugees. Only $4.4 billion was raised. The U.S. had pledged $1 billion, but has not delivered on any of that. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News political analyst, and he's the producer of this show. Welcome back, Walter.
Good to be here.
Walter, $4.4 billion was raised. $9.2 billion is what the United Nations says is needed. So what happens now with all these refugees with less than half the money necessary to resettle them or to get them back into Syria and into their homes?
Yeah, it seems like the crisis is just going to drag on and on and on, and people are going to be, I mean, these are children, I mean, people who can't meet the very basic necessities of life, who are fleeing this horrible war that was caused, I mean, in large part by the United States. And now, you know, they don't have any problem sending in, you know, 50 cruise missiles, now 100 cruise missiles. But when it comes to humanitarian aid, they're not so interested in it.
There's a congressman from Illinois by the name of Adam Kinzinger. He's on MSNBC all the time, although he's a Republican and quite conservative. He has sponsored a bill in the House of Representatives called the No Assistance for Assad Act. I think that's what this comes down to, is the Republicans have a narrative now that any aid to resettle refugees, any aid to rebuild the country in any way is somehow aid to Assad. And it's funny, too, because it's these same Republicans who are arguing against the presence of any refugees here in the United States. It stands to reason, then, if you don't want them here and the Europeans don't want them in their countries, that you would want to work to resettle them in Syria and to help rebuild an infrastructure. But that's not been the case, has it?
No, it's definitely not been the case. And also, you know, just the name of that bill is pretty interesting, the No Help to Assad Act, right? So the idea that, you know, the Syrian government, the Syrian state is completely personalized in this one individual who is, you know, the root of all evil. I mean, he's the devil incarnate. And so that really, I think, blurs the reasons why, you know, certain, you know, well, large sections of the Syrian population, the majority of the Syrian population would actually prefer to live in areas governed by the central government, the Damascus government. which would be completely cut off from any type of humanitarian and reconstruction support by this bill introduced by Adam Kinzinger. You know, the reasons why people want to live there is not necessarily because they're, you know, like themselves Baathists. I mean, you know, the Baath Party has existed in the country for a long time. It does have supporters. But, you know, I think what the Syrian government represents to people is secularism, like the idea that we're going to live in a non-sectarian civil Syria that will be unified and have some measure of independence. I mean, you know, when the demonstrations were starting in 2011 in Syria, not long after they began, a chant became popular among the more like Salafists, you know, right-wing religious elements. And it was Christians to Beirut, Alawites to the grave, right? So we're going to expel all the Christians from the country and kill all the Alawites. I mean, that's truly an expression, I think, of the orientation of the bulk of the Syrian opposition.
And that sounds like the Saudi government's actual policy.
Mm-hmm. And when ISIS needed to find textbooks for the schools that they set up in the areas under their control, they went online and found PDFs of textbooks that were used in Saudi schools. And then they just printed it out, and that became the ISIS textbooks.
Yeah, that's super important. I mean, let's go back. There were protests against the Assad government in 2011, as there were against many, many governments in the Arab world. That was called the Arab Spring. The U.S. had just been bombing. The U.S. had been bombing Libya and destroyed the Libyan government, the government of Gaddafi, and Gaddafi was finally lynched in the streets. To which Hillary Clinton said, "We came, we saw, he died." She was laughing about that the day he was lynched. But that protest movement almost immediately turned into an armed struggle. And you had Saudi Arabia, and you had Turkey, and you had Qatar. And of course, behind the scenes, you had the US CIA and other organizations funneling money and weapons to armed factions against the Assad government. That's actually what happened. Now, that war, which still goes on today, there were 22 million Syrians in 2011. By 2016, there were 11 million refugees. 5 million were outside the country, 5 million refugees outside the country, 6 million refugees inside the country. So you actually had one out of every two people, according to the United Nations Committee on Refugees, who were refugees. I mean, then, of course, refugees in a war-torn area, and the war doesn't stop, they want comfort, they want safety. They can go to a refugee camp, or they can try to leave. And when they tried to leave, they were then became the political football for right-wing movements in Europe who said, these Muslims are coming and destroying European cultures and European values and national values. And so in all ways, the Syrian people in all ways have been the real victims and the humanitarian disaster that has befallen them. I mean, if you're a Syrian person right now, whether you like Assad or don't like Assad, you want this war to end. You don't want to be a refugee. You want to go home. At the beginning of the protest movement, there was an opposition to the Assad government, a real significant opposition that did not want to participate in armed struggles, especially those financed by foreign powers. They were pushed to the side so that the U.S. and its proxies like Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, elevated the Salafist, right-wing Islamicist political organizations to take the place of those other Syrians who were opposed to Assad but did not want the country to go to war.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, there is a whole there is a coalition that still to a certain degree exists that was based on the three no's, no to sectarianism, no to I believe no to foreign intervention and no to violence. Right. But that, you know, that section of the opposition quickly became like extremely marginalized. And so you have the quote unquote Free Syrian Army is often referred to in the Western and
the
corporate
moderate
press.
Rebels.
Yeah, but the Free Syrian Army doesn't even mean anything. I mean, it's more like a brand than an actual organization. I mean, initially it referred to those brigades and divisions of the Syrian armed forces that defected at the beginning of the conflict when it looked like the government was going to sort of like imminently fall. So there were a lot of defectors. But now it's become just this like catch-all that can, you know, any group can adopt the, you know, the
and
label
we know,
of the
And we know
Syrian
from
Army.
Media reports, even those acknowledged by the U.S., that the arms shipments that went to the Free Syrian Army from the U.S. or its allies. Those guys gave their weapons or sold their weapons or had their weapons captured by Al-Qaeda.
Sure they did. And in fact, the CIA, even after arming them, and this was well documented on the CBS News program 60 Minutes, never provided bullets. They gave them the guns, but no bullets. And then the guns ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that happened in the north of the country, along the Turkish border, where, you know, not only for a long time, I mean, ISIS fighters were allowed to more or less freely cross the border. But it was sort of, you know, the staging area for all sorts of different very repressive, theocratic organizations as they are today. Like when Turkey launched Operation Euphrates Shield, or, you know, their more recent invasion of Afrin, the Kurdish-controlled areas in the north, you know, the Turkish military provides, like, artillery support. They send in tanks. They conduct airstrikes. But, you know, the bulk of the fighting on the ground is done by Syrian opposition forces. And what did the Turkish government decide to label them? Well, they're Free Syrian Army fighters. But, you know, if you look at the videos, if you look at the images of what Afrin City looked like after it was captured by, you know, the quote unquote Free Syrian Army, I mean, it was horrible. The abuses that were going on, you know, people being kidnapped, people being executed in the streets, you know, the any symbol that points to, you know, a civil democratic secular type of governing system, they're all torn away. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Turkey likes to present itself like, oh, well, we're welcoming all of these Syrians into our territory. We're the truly generous ones. But, you know, there's all sorts of cynical maneuvering going on there. One is that Turkish businessmen are able to horribly exploit Syrian refugees who, you know, technically are not permitted to work in the country, but, you know, of course, will and can be paid, you know, extremely low wages, horribly, horribly exploited. There's also, you know, the calculation that, well, if the Turkish legislature passed a law that would, you know, allow refugees after a certain number of years living in the country to become voters, with a calculation that they would naturally support the AKP, Erdogan's party, and so it would sort of further shift the Turkish electorate in their favor. So, and of course, you know, Turkey in the beginning was one of the people egging on the civil war that caused this unbelievable humanitarian catastrophe. So I think their rhetoric about refugees is also, you know, just as hollow as the United States is.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. So we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. Walter is the producer of this show, but he's also an esteemed Sputnik News political analyst. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines from across the country. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And we're joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and producer of this show. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Delighted to join you.
John, I see that one of the headlines is relates to a story we talked about with the Lookmans.
Yes.
In our last hour.
It does indeed. I was going to mention that too.
It seems redundant, but it's so, well, it's not that it's a bad headline. The story is
bad. The story's egregious.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about it twice.
Yeah, Steve, it says, National Guard called out to protect election from Russian hacking. How is that even physically possible?
Yeah, I think people better hide under their desks. Cause,
the National Guard is coming to protect us from the Russians at the midterm election?
The Russian hackers, who I suspect are in Russia, right?
Oh, so it's not going to be National Guard military forces in uniform, machine guns at hand at the polling place?
Well, that's what it says.
No. National Guard called out. Sounds like they're going to be there at the
it does, but that isn't what the story is about. Actually, the headline is quite misleading. It's really they're going to try to enlist people in the National Guard to help detect security breaches, so-called, you know, cyber attacks and so on, which is really kind of a ludicrous idea on many fronts. The funny line in the article, to me anyway, says that a 2017 RAND report estimated that the Army National Guard and Army Reserve and more than 100,000 people with some cyber competence,
which basically
means they know how to use Microsoft Word, I think.
That's great.
Or they know how to browse the web.
Well, this headline gives me the vision of National Guardsmen standing at the polling place. Maybe are they trying to shoot their machine guns through the ballot box and all the way to Russia? Do they think that might work?
Yeah, they're going to it's sort of when you hear that there might be military forces called out. That's the headline. And Steve, I know you think it's misleading, but we're talking about misleading headlines.
Right.
You know, that leaves the impression that when you go to vote in West Virginia, and perhaps now it's a growing trend in other states where governors might be calling out the National Guard to stop Russian meddling in the 2018 election, you might be seeing troops. I mean, it sends a little bit of a chilling message about whether people want to, or all people want to, actually come to the polls, no?
For sure. Like I said, people should start hiding under their desks instead of going to vote because the Russians are coming. It's pretty clear from the headline.
By the way, that is the name of the 1965 movie with Alan Arkin, The Russians Are Coming, which made fun of the hysteria of the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, the anti-Soviet, anti-Russian witch hunt.
I think we should do a remake.
Maybe here at Radio Sputnik, we can do a screening of The Russians Are Coming with Alan Arkin. And at that time, liberals loved The Russians Are Coming because it was, you know, a pro-peace, anti-Cold War movie. It made fun of the idea that a Russian submarine had landed in New England. I don't know whether it was Cape Cod or somewhere. The Russian commandante wanted to see America and he got too close. And the whole country went into a great fervor, you know, trying to stop the fact that America was being taken over by Russians. Here we are, 2018. I think a lot of liberals in this case will just say, yeah, go for it, West Virginia governor, call out the National Guard.
I think we should do a remake, and Brian, you should be the star. I think that would be a great film. I would absolutely see that.
The star?
The star.
Wow. John.
The star?
John, let's move on, even though this is so fascinating. I think we want to come up with some other headlines. Where do you want to go, Steve?
Let's go to the next one, which is a hot topic in the news, which is the OPCW in Syria, the chemical weapons claims. As listeners may know, there have been some Syrian witnesses now in Geneva, I guess it is, testifying to the OPCW about how they were just participating in this video, which was a fake. But here's the way the media has been handling it in the West. The Washington Post headline says, Britain, France denounce Russian claim as a stunt. Well, these weren't Russian claims. These were claims by Syrians, people who were actually, you know, in Douma at the time of the alleged attack. even worse than that, here's a headline from Yahoo News. Said, Russia parades Syrian, quote, witnesses to disprove gas attack. And same thing in Sky News. Russia parades Syrian, quote, witnesses to prove, quote, what really happened in Douma. Now, why that's outrageous is that the people who they're talking about were several doctors and this young boy who claims he was given candy to go get washed off with water in the video. There's no question that these were witnesses.
These were literally the people in the video.
Exactly. We can prove that they were there because they're in the video. They're clearly more witnesses.
I bet they're just twins. That's what it was. The one wasn't there, and then the one was in the video. You don't know, Steve. You don't know. These are, you know, real claims. We're just not sure.
I mean, the claim by which all the Western media is pushing is that they were coerced, which could be true, I suppose, but they have no evidence for that. Like I say, the fact that they immediately frame the whole thing as a stunt or that these weren't really witnesses is just outrageous.
Right.
And
which is
totally
something
biases.
And that's something that they didn't do when the U.S. paraded the daughter of Kuwait's ambassador to the United States to say that Iraqi soldiers had pulled babies out of incubators and thrown them on the ground after they invaded Kuwait.
Everybody believed that, by the way.
Everybody believed that.
Because that was the dominant. I mean, we had to go to war against Iraq because
they were killing babies.
They were taking babies off of incubators to take the incubators from Kuwait City back to Baghdad.
That's
part of colonial loot.
That's
Except
right.
the testifier, the witness, was the daughter.
The daughter of Kuwait's ambassador, Saud Nasra Sabah.
Just dressed up as a nurse or something.
Not to get too far off the subject, but I remember watching her testimony live when I was still at the CIA, and I said to colleagues, wait a minute, isn't that Saud Nasser's daughter? And we all kind of looked at each other like, uh-oh. Sorry, Steve, go right ahead.
No, that's all right.
They're doing the same thing in Syria now.
The funniest part of this to me is this poor kid who's being paraded around from, you know, one moment he's getting candy and then being, you know, soaked with water.
Yeah.
And then he just looks so confused in all of these videos. He's like, why? I just want a candy, y'all. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Now he's being paraded around on stage, still looks confused, just not sure why he has to be doing any of this.
Steve, I wanted to ask you about this case in California. I have been following every detail of this, the arrest of the Golden State Killer. You've got a nice take on it. There's an LA Times article entitled "Long Tortured Hunt for Golden State Killer Leads to Arrest of Ex-Cop." Why is that controversial?
Well, the outrageous thing about this, and this has been true in all the media, it was true in the San Jose Mercury News and some other things I read, is that they do mention he's an ex-cop, but they never actually say that he committed almost all of his horrible crimes. He raped like 52 people and killed a dozen or so. He committed almost all of those crimes. 52 out of 59 of the incidents were committed while he was a cop.
Right. And nobody is talking about that.
While he was a cop.
He's not just an ex-cop. He was committing these crimes while he was a cop. And for example, in the San Jose Mercury News, buried in the article, it said he was a cop in the 70s and so on. And then on the side was this sidebar with a list of all the crimes and the dates. And you had to yourself compare the two and say, wait a minute, he was a cop when he did all these things. They never actually tell you that. And most of the articles, there's not a single article I've read that actually makes that point explicit, which was, of course, a key point and probably what one could expect. It was a key point in helping to keep him out of the grips of the cops, the fact that he was a cop at the time he was committing these crimes. So it's an important point.
It is.
But one which is totally
It really neglected. Is an important point. And the fact that he was never a suspect.
No, never a suspect. The Washington Post ended its article covering this arrest in the oddest way. The final paragraph said that he was arrested without incident. And when the cops told him, you're under arrest for being the Golden State Killer, he said, I have a roast in the oven. And they said, okay, we'll take care of that for you. And so they went into his house and turned the oven off.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That was his concern?
Yeah, that he had a roast in the oven.
Well, you
but
guys,
what freaked me out was that the Washington Post
overcooked.
Carried it. You know?
Yeah.
Like, how is that at all germane to the heinous crimes that this man committed?
We have 1 minute left, Steve.
They're the ultimate foodies, you know? They're just really concerned.
Here's a terrible headline. Her rare disease costs millions to treat. To drug companies, she's a human jackpot. 1 minute left. It's not funny, as you said. It's not misleading, as you said. It's just disgusting, as you also said. Go ahead.
Yeah. What I discovered from this article, which I didn't know, probably people who are more experts in healthcare know this, is that what happened here is, she is essentially being bankrupted her whole life by the cost of drugs. But to try to make it a little better for her, the pharmaceutical companies, instead of lowering the price of their drugs and cutting their own profits, they actually donate money to some essentially fake charity, thereby getting themselves a tax break. And then the charity helps pay for the drugs to make it a little bit easier for these people to get by. Although, if you read the article, she's barely getting by. It's just the most disgusting explicit story about what's wrong with the health quote-unquote care system in the United States and
it is.
Why we need a single payer system.
You're right, Steve. It's not funny. It's not misleading. It's just disgusting.
We're going to have to leave it there, though, folks. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we were joined in studio by Nicole Russell, who's a producer of the show and a Sputnik News analyst. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. You can also follow us now at Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.